Join us in person or online for Canada's only occult conference. Visit Vancouver in beautiful British Columbia and help us leave lockdowns behind us and get back to life. The first of four Dee and Kelly conferences over the next 4 years support the Arcane Research Society in bringing excellence in academic scholarship and practical knowledge from some of the best scholars and occultists in the field. Featuring in 2024 this summer, Dr. Terry Burns, translator of Dr. John Dee's famous Monus Hieroglyphica. Dr. Burns has just completed a 52-video course on this mystical text, which you can watch on YouTube for free. Join us and experts Rufus Opus, P.D. Newman, J. Allen Moore, Daniel Rekshan, Frater R.C., and more for this exciting event, which will explore the angelic and spirit-filled world of Elizabethan mages, Dr. John Dee, and the alchemist Sir Edward Kelly. Learn the secrets of drawing spirits into crystals, conjuration, and Enochian angel magic, as well as the role of dreams and their connections to these other extra-dimensional realities and alchemical transformation. Sign up today to attend online or in person at EnochiaCon.com, presented by the Arcane Research Society. Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support. All right, welcome to Magic Without Fears. P.D. Newman, you're my guest here today to discuss Angels in Vermilion, amongst other things, such as your new book, Theurgy, which is out now and available. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I thought it would be fun to start off with just a quote from your book where you quote someone else, and this is Paracelsus. There are therefore two kinds of knowledge in this world, an eternal and a temporal. The eternal springs directly from the light of the Holy Spirit, but the other directly from the light of nature. It's such a beautiful passage, and the book of nature is what we're here to talk about, really. From the Genesis all the way up to John Dee and Strassman in our own, in the past century? No, in this century. It's this century, isn't it? Yeah. I remember hearing first about DMT and Strassman's work when I was in seminary. They talked about it in class. Some student mentioned it, and the teachers addressed it briefly, but no one really knew much about it. And I was going to get the book after class that day when I went down to Banyan Books in Vancouver, and I just saw it on the shelf, and just I was like, I don't know. I just didn't know anything about it, so I didn't get it. And I wish I had, because it would have changed my life. It, fast forward from that day in the early 2000s to 2019, after the Berlin Occulture Conference, me and one of the coordinators had a Changa experience. Well, he was the shaman and I was the quester. And boy, did I have my entire understanding of reality fundamentally changed, which isn't is a great lot to say after the life I've lived. So, yeah.
It really was. DMT was before Strassman's book. You know, we had people like the McKenna brothers talking about it, but if you weren't reading, you know, anthropological literature and ethnobotany and things, it really was kind of this big question mark for most of the world.
So the beginning of DMT in our world isn't in the 20th century with the intramuscular injection by, is it Merkur who did that or someone, a Swiss guy?
Stefan István Zara,
Yes.
Hungarian.
And he's accredited officially with discovering the psychedelic qualities of DMT.
That's right.
But as I learned in your book, Angels in Vermilion, The Philosopher's Stone from D to DMT, Cagliostro, Melusina, and all these other guys in the 17th and 18th century, and maybe as late as the 19th century, were putting people in coffins during the Russian and Egyptian rites of Freemasonry, along with some DMT. Is that
That's right.
correct? That's correct. So it wasn't that big of a discovery, really, that we made in the 20th and 21st century regarding DMT, it seems.
It was really just a rebranding.
Why do you think it didn't catch on amongst broader Freemasonry?
I think it did. I think it did, but it was kept, kind of hush hush. And so the reason I think that it did is when I began this research, I started reading through every version of the Master Mason degree that I could find, the Master Mason degree being the degree wherein Acacia is referenced. And I couldn't find a single reference to it prior to 1730s-ish. Nothing. You would find a reference to Cassia. But Cassia and Acacia aren't the same thing. And while Cassia does contain psychoactive compounds, it contains eugenol and coumarin, just like cinnamon does. Its use in the early form of the Master Mason degree seems to have more to do with the fact that it was used in the process of mummification in ancient Egypt. So it has to do with this death ritual that's being performed. And it's not until this man named John Theophilus de Sagulier becomes the third Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge in London that he rewrites the Master Mason degree and inserts the Acacia into it. The big question then becomes, why did he do that? And where did he get the Acacia? And the answer to that is even more mind-boggling and outrageous. But the Masons that were present for this ritual change were so impressed by de Sagulier's innovations that they had a parade for it. All the Masons got out in the streets and walked in this huge parade, playing music and carrying these giant they're the tracing boards, but they've got them on like pickets. And they're showing for the first time. This is the first time that we have in the literature, this scene was drawn, sketched, etched out. It's the first time we see the Master Mason tracing board with the acacia right there at the top, and they're carrying this on a big stick, walking through the streets, basically, celebrating this change that he made. And that wasn't common. That's not common now. To something happens in Masonry, Masons generally stay in the lodge, but this caused a parade.
And the cassia or cassis, does that have other
Cassia.
cassia? That's not the same as the gum arabic.
No, so cassia is like cinnamon. It's from southern China. And most of what people buy in the store in America as cinnamon is actually cassia. It's very hard to tell the difference. They taste, smell, look the same. And that's what's referenced. But it's not in the same context either, even though this death motif is present. In the version that de Sagulier presented and the version he wrote, it's central to it. You're the individual going through the mystery. He is playing the character just like you would in the ancient mysteries, where you would play the part of maybe Dionysus or Persephone, the character who is playing Hiram Abiff, who himself is a type of Osiris, Dionysus, he's buried beneath the acacia. He's in the roots of this tree.
But that's not the, but that came into masonry along the way. It wasn't there in the beginning
That's
to,
right. It's
right.
not present in the
And so what
beginning.
does that really represent? Is it a re birth of alchemy or an entrance of alchemical practitioners like Ashmole into the Masonic?
It definitely comes from alchemy. Alchemy feeds into masonry at this point. So we have to really get the big picture, at least for this section, this part of it, we have to go back to the earliest days of alchemy, which is in Panopolis in Egypt, which is modern day Akhmin. And there's a man named Zosimos. And Zosimos is by trade, he makes statues. He makes statuary for temples, and he animates them. He's a statue animator. And what I mean by this isn't that he makes some mechanical statue that moves like a robot. He instills them with anima, as in soul. He's ensouling statues with the gods that those statues are built to represent. And this is important because it plays into what alchemy became and what he thought of alchemy as. So he has a student, a woman named Theosebia, and she is learning astrology. And she's in the process of learning astrology from the Egyptian priesthood. And she is learning from Zosimos, because she's studying alchemy under him, that she shouldn't be doing astrology. He tells her that astrology is the means by which basically the archons, because he's a Gnostic Christian, these archons enmesh men further into fate, further into matter. But that alchemy is designed to take the soul out of that, relieve it from the fetters of matter, and make it no longer subject to fate. And so what he starts teaching her is all of this stuff about metallurgy, about metals and minerals and things. And she doesn't get it. She says, I don't understand what this has to do with anything. What does this have to do with me learning astrology? How does this have anything to do with my soul? And to answer her, he literally draws her a picture. He draws her a book of pictures. It's called Mushaf Asuvar, which translates to the Book of Pictures. And in it, he explains that the techniques of alchemy to protect them from the idly curious are concealed under terms of an art, of a practice, whose processes are analogous to those of alchemy. And for him, that's metallurgy. That's what he knows. So he's concealing alchemy under metallurgical terms. And he's talking to her about cinnabar, this red mineral that it's basically sulfur and mercury,
That's what the Sufis called the red sulfur, right?
the red sulfur, that's right. Well, he's telling her about cinnabar, but after he explains to her what he means, he goes on to say that what this really is acacia. Acacia is this red wood that contains the philosopher's stone in it. The big mystery in alchemy is, what is the prima materia? What is the first matter? Because if you can figure that out, then you can get the philosopher's stone from it. And with that, you can quote unquote transmute base metals into gold. You can tincture them. And so he reveals that it's really acacia that they're doing this with. And it's from acacia that this stone comes from. Well, in the same region, another text emerges called the Turba Philosophorum, very famous alchemical text. It
Yeah, I
was the
just went
first
through it recently in Burns's course.
Okay. It was the first alchemical text to reach Europe. And it originates in Panopolis, in modern day Akhmin, where Zosimos lived. It's part of his same lineage, his same transmission. And in this document, We have all of these philosophers. It's usually translated, Turba is translated as assembly of the philosophers, but Turba doesn't mean an assembly. It means more like they're arguing, the argument of the philosophers. And you have all of these philosophers from all these different times. It's impossible to take place because you have Parmenides, Empedocles, Xenophanes, and then you have Plato and Aristotle and Moses. All of these philosophers that are arguing with each other about what is the philosopher's stone, what is the prima materia. And Moses interjects and he says, well, I'll tell you, exactly what it is. And he says, when we talk about copper, this red metal, what we really mean is acacia, this red wood. And it's from acacia that we produce the substance that causes the action. And this is the kind of thing that, and we know that Dee had this in his possession. He quotes it at one point. He quotes the Turba where it says, nature rejoices in nature. So we know that he was reading it, that he had access to this document. And Dee and Kelly, of course, get together, and Dee's big thing is he wants to talk to angels, largely for political reasons, but he isn't able to. He can't get them to talk back to him. And so he gets in the habit of employing these scryers, seers, who can see and talk to them. And he goes through several that he's not happy with until finally a man comes to him, which is Edward Kelly, and he says, I can do this. I can do this for you. Well, he doesn't say it at the time, but the reason he sought D out in the first place was because he was in possession of this red powder. The red powder isn't named, we don't know what it was. But along with it, he had this manuscript known as the Book of Dunstan. And Dunstan was the father of monasticism in Europe. And he was also a metallurgist.
Yeah,
So,
a sword
and
back too, apparently, from battling the devil in his tiny
that's
cell
right.
that
That's
he couldn't
right.
stand up in,
And
punishing himself for
dragging him
his.
out by his by the blacksmith tongs, by his nose. That's the same
Great,
Dunstan.
great story. Yeah,
And
awesome.
metallurgy and alchemy have a long history together. Like we said, Zosimos is a metallurgist. He's a statue maker. And so Kelly is under the impression that this manuscript, this Book of Dunstan, has the tells them how to make more of this red powder, but it's in a cipher he can't understand. Well, that's why he approaches D. He doesn't unveil this until years later, but he tells D, I'm your man. I can talk to angels. And he's immediately successful. And anyone who has thumbed through the Enochian papers realizes this, something was going on between those two men and those angels. Something was taking place. But how they were accomplishing it wasn't really spelled out. And this is where it gets really interesting to me. So after Dee and Kelly part ways, a man named Elias Ashmole, an antiquary from Lichfield, who happened to be one of the earliest speculative masons, and by that I mean not an operative mason. But prior to this, masonry was a guild, and anyone involved in it were building houses, cathedrals. They were active builders. But for some reason, around this time, they started admitting men who are more like philosophers and hermetists and alchemists into the fraternity. Ashmole is one of these. And Ashmole has a keen interest in alchemy. He wrote two books on alchemy. Fasciculus Chemicus was one, and the other is Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum, which was surprisingly successful. And in that one, he actually has a piece from Kelly, and there's called Sir Edward Kelly's Work. That's a phenomenal poem that is full of subtle hints and references to what they were doing. He makes references to Hermes' tree, distilling the oil from Hermes' tree. But so what happens at this point is, Ashmole inherits all of Dee's papers. He becomes his archivist and immediately sets to work trying to make them work. He's doing Enochian magic to try and talk to angels, but he's unable to do it. He can't make it work. And he comes to the conclusion that it must be this red powder. This red powder that Kelly had must be the thing that allowed him to see angels. So he brings this problem to none other than Robert Boyle, the first chemist, the president of the Royal Society. And he says, I'm trying to figure out what this red powder is that you can talk to angels with. Well, lo and behold, Boyle is also researching a red powder that was in the possession of another alchemist named Wenzel Seyler, who, according to St. George Ashe, got that powder from Edward Kelly when he met them in Prague. So Boyle and Ashmole are looking for the same thing, trying to figure out what this is. And being the scientific mind that Boyle was, he immediately thought, well, it's a physical substance that causes this supernatural effect, then it must be a drug. This must be a drug we're looking for. And it's at this point that he issues a document that's known as Boyle's to-do list. It's also been called Boyle's wish list. And it was put on display at the Royal Society in 2010. You can see it on their website. It is full of drugs. He wants to acquire different forms of hashish, like dawamesk and majun. He wants to find, he says, the fungus mentioned by the French author, literally magic mushrooms. He wants any drug that will cause pleasing dreams, deep sleep, superhuman strength. He wants them all brought to him so they can test each one of them and see which one will cause this angelic revelation. So this is where Acacia comes in. In their possession at the Royal Society were the papers of an alchemist named Samuel Hartlib, who was a contemporary of Boyle. And in his papers, he says in no uncertain terms that the prima materia of alchemy is the acacia. And from it, using this specific process, which he outlines, you get a crystalline stone. And that's their cue. That's how Acacia enters the dialogue to begin with, to start with. Well, among them was also Sir Isaac Newton, another scientist intensely interested in alchemy. He had a assistant who was this John Theophilus de Sagulier that became the third Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge in London. So he brings this acacia with him, this knowledge with him, and restructures the Masonic order, the rituals, based on what they discover with that acacia. Now, we don't know what they did with it. We don't know because there's no papers written up about it. You know, the curator of experiments at the time was Robert Hooke, and he does have two lectures he gave on the psychological and physiological effects of hashish, trying it on himself from this era. You know, so we know they're going through the drugs, trying them, they're being presented to the Royal Society. But this appears to be where Acacia entered Freemasonry. And so that's why I say, when you ask in the beginning, why didn't this catch on in regular Masonry? Well, I think the only reason Cagliostro really knew about it was because it had already caught on in regular Masonry. They were
I
just doing
see.
it kind of under the table, maybe, or were really keeping quiet about it.
Well, I mean, think about this. You and I are both experienced journeyers into the hyperspace, which is what DMT users call that sort of spirit world, is how I think of it, though. You call me old-fashioned, but hyperspace is a good name. If you haven't actually experienced it, and I wrote it off for years because I was like, well, I've done other psychedelics. I don't need to do them all. You know, how different can it be? That's why
Right.
I wrote it off for 15 years. Yeah. But if I was imagining I was one of these royal fellows with their very hard, laborious jobs testing drugs all day, and I came across.
Slaving away.
anything even similar to either a partial experience like a week Chaga trip or a full DMT breakthrough. If I came across that when I was testing things, I would lose my shit. Pardon my language, but I would fucking lose my fucking mind and be like, holy, oh my God, the universe is vast, infinite, and alive and intelligent, and we're a part of it. And I talk to this guy, and he's like, I'm the spirit of love. Or I
And
talk to another guy, he's like, I'm going to destroy your life.
they know it's a drug, but you have to think at the time there is no war on drugs. There's the biggest problems that society had with drugs would have been anyone who drank too much, which wasn't really an issue because Masonry started in a pub. The drinking was the norm. There were some issues with laudanum and opium addiction, especially once they had colonized India, because opium was this real problem in those areas. But beyond those limited instances, there is no concept of holy shit, I'm on a drug. They would have very much approached this like, holy shit, I'm seeing what Ezekiel saw, or I'm seeing what John of Patmos saw. This would have these were religious men. De Sagulier was a minister. So they would have very much interpreted this as a proof of spiritual reality. And I think that's really why he wanted to put it in Masonry anyway, was so that those being initiated into the fraternity would be able to act on gnosis, not faith, but gnosis, to know for a fact there is a spiritual plane and that there are things that I do here that affect it over there. Once you know that, once it clicks, ritual all of the sudden becomes practical. It becomes necessary in some cases, whereas for someone who had no idea what ritual was, they're Protestants. They've cut out the liturgy. They don't even know what ritual looks like. So for Masons coming in at that time, ritual would have been such a foreign concept that I'm sure there was a problem of why are we doing this? But you give them a glimpse of the other side, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, why haven't I been doing this?
I might you triggered my Anglo-Catholic cap coming on, and as an Anglican, I can tell you that the liturgy that they would have experienced is far more similar to the traditional Roman rite than anything we see even in a Roman Catholic church today. So they were experiencing something far more similar to what we'd consider the Ultradentine Roman rite than what we're seeing today. So
Well,
certainly
these
some of
guys
the
were Protestants, though,
Yeah,
not
Protestant
Anglican.
Anglicans, though.
I
Because this was just really, I don't want to get into it, but the Anglican Church is very clearly divided, but still one, into high Anglicans, which are very similar to Catholics, low Anglicans, which are very Calvinistic Protestants. You'll see like suit and tie, common clothes. But again, the clothing thing is something is a recent development. So back then, like the little black collar is just the cravat that shrunk over time. The churchman just didn't give it up, but it comes from the cravat. It's not anything special, that little white square that we use. But the rite would have been, yeah, they would have been seeing huge, what we would call Catholic masses, is all I'm saying. You could have gone to
I didn't
churches that
imagine
were,
that. I imagine
so
that
it
with
was all there.
Catholics,
It was all happening. They had all kinds of denominations. Like you had the Methodists coming, doing their thing outside in the fields, and
and that's what they were. They were the Methodist variety.
Yeah, I'm just
That's
saying that
why.
there's such a wide variety. It's not like they would have when they thought of the mass, if they thought of the mass, they would have seen the extravagant mass that we imagine today, but seldom get to behold.
Right, I know
That's
like
about
Pascali, the Elu Cohen, those guys, they were devout Catholics and they were going to mass every chance they had. But James Anderson, De Sagulier, I think they were Methodist ministers,
Yeah, then
but
they might have been, they might have rejected it. They still would have seen it. But I think if
they
they
would have
wanted to
seen
be
it,
familiar with ritual, they had very easy
but my
access to complex ritual, is all I think I'm saying, really.
My point is, they would have asked, why are we doing it?
Yes, of course. Well, that's the whole point of this. Pardon my tangent. I just, you put my Anglican hat on, and I had to educate the world as to my fabulous denomination.
I'm definitely not educated when it comes to Anglican. I'm personally Orthodox, and I was raised Southern Baptist, which was a nightmare in itself. But Anglican, I'm sorely uneducated in.
Well, I think that they're really just one of the few denominations that let you be a heretic and still be forgiven. I find the idea though that Kelly came into the relation with D, well, he wasn't using the powder to see visions, it certainly not in the beginning scryings. And there's no reference to it later on. Originally, my belief was, well, they would have mentioned it in the diaries because there was no laws against drugs. But then Leach pointed out to me when I talked to Aaron, right? That they were showing them to the nuncios, of course, and that they was still could have been in trouble for pharmacy or witchcraft, actually, if they were using ointments and cunning craft. So
And they
actually,
mentioned
there was a reason to
ointments.
keep reference to it out of the diaries.
I'm sure
So.
you remember the section where they're trying to contact the angel, and an angel comes, but he says, "Your apothecary box is empty. How do you purport to contact me?" And then he says something like, "I guess you'll have to, the ointments will have to do, you know."
Yeah, so this is where you quoted that from Chris Bennett's Liber 420 in your book right here. You quoted Chris Bennett's passage, and he's quoting Whitby. And I couldn't find it in Whitby, though I'm sure it actually is there. And what's really funny, you're gonna love this, brother. You're gonna love this. So you can find it in the back, but it's in the appendices, the extra days. And here's the most far. So if Chris had actually gone to the Peterson, thing, or if you had. If you realize Chris's citation was slightly off and gone to this yourself, you guys would have noticed that
Well,
that
I
comes.
actually got it from Peterson, but
Okay,
we
just the.
lost. We had a house fire. I lost all of my books.
Yeah, because there's no citation. But
So
anyway, the
when
cool
it
thing
came
is,
time
this
to
is what you
do.
have to say. You have to say this in the second edition of this that's coming out because you're going to love it. So
Oh, let me have it. Hit
the
me.
reference to the drugs occurs right here. Where is it? Right here on. April 20th.
Oh, that's a good date.
How wild is that?
And Chris would have jumped right on that too.
Yeah, but this in primary source material. God love him. So very interesting. And it took me a while to figure out who was saying what to whom. But what does appear, and it's very confusing. What I could figure out is that I have no idea why they're talking about drugs. It looks like one of the wives might need an ointment for her health or something like that. But I, yeah, please, I really hope I'd love a further investigation of that in your second edition. That would be absolutely delightful. Because it is a very interesting passage. It stands out, especially as it's the only single time that the word drug or drugs is used, as far as anyone can find in the diaries. All right. April
Hang on.
20th.
Let me grab my
April.
book. I've got it. Hang on.
So it's the first page right after of the appendix. It's very easy to find, actually, the first page of the appendix.
Thank you, buddy.
It was so much fun. I hope people are enjoying this.
All right, tell me
First
the
page
page you're
after.
on.
So it's a page 364.
Six, four.
But the actual reference is 366. Droggs.
Yeah,
366, top left,
drogas.
drugs. So the Illumise the spirit says, I know what all your talk hath been, but such minds, such infection, such corruption, and must needs have a potion applicable for the cure. But how will you do? I have forgotten all my drugs behind me. But since I know that some of you are well stored with sufficient ointments, I do intend to visit you only with their help. You see, all my boxes are empty. Then dash EK. He showeth a great bundle of empty potichery boxes, and they seem to my hearing to rattle and then detox. So, yeah, interesting,
That's
eh?
in the book. That's in Angels in Vermilion.
Yes, that's what I showed the page. I showed where you referenced Chris Bennett citing that place.
Oh, you're telling me this is where the original is.
That's where it actually comes from, and it's been
Gotcha.
cited in other places.
Yeah,
And
yeah, yeah.
by going to the original, you find out it happened on 420.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
The only
Have you
reference to the
read?
D's diaries, to drugs in D's diaries, was on 420. How do you like
Have you
that map?
read? Well, I can't. It's not showing up. Eckhart Schausen's Principles of, it's called Magic, the Principles of Higher Knowledge.
I don't know the book personally.
Okay, well, he's famous for writing Cloud Upon the Sanctuary. That was
Cool.
a one of the Crowley would have you'd have to read that in the student grade in AA. But he gives a list. First, he gives a theory on why drugs are magical, what they're doing physiologically. But he gives a list of different drugs that, as I researched each one of them, I wondered if some of the things, because this is 2 centuries after D, 1.5, 2 centuries. But when he talks about the ointments, well, the ointments I tend to associate with flying ointments, mandrake and things like that. Well, he gives ointments in here that are based on the acacia ointments that are used. And
Wow, that's
some of the
huge,
ones
isn't it?
he gives is
Gives us a lot of context.
he says Mithridates, which those were the only re there's one recipe left for a Mithridate that it involved rue, leaves of rue, probably savage rue, Syrian rue. It involved opium and something else. And then he gives something called theriacs. And I, off the top of my head, I can't tell you what's in each one of them. I have them broken down in a paper, which I can forward you. But he says trifera, laudanum paracelsi, we know what that is, diascordium, felonium, and pilule de sinoglossa. And sinoglossa means tongue of the dog, hound's tongue. But at least three or four of those were sold as women's medicines for cramps, for to help with birth, things like that. And they involve vast concentrations of acacia in them. So, when he says, my boxes are empty, but he has the ointments. That's a whole new rabbit hole now that I'm going to have to crawl my way down.
And the spirit is the one that has forgot its drugs.
Right. What does that mean,
I mean, I'm very grateful to you and Chris Bennett for bringing this stuff to my attention and to our attention, because I want answers. And I've been like a dog with a bone on this subject since, meeting you guys and finding out about your work and everything. And
It makes me think of, so let's put it in a context. We'll look at it logically. With the Theosophical Society, you've got these hidden masters, right, that are purportedly real men, but they're spiritual adepts, and they can appear or not appear, and can appear as though they're angels because they're etheric and things like this. Well, in Olcott's old diary leaves, he talks about this moment where I think it's Hilarion, one of the hidden masters, comes to his apartment, and he's living in an apartment directly above Blavatsky. And this is a real person knocking on his door. And the first thing he does is offers Olcott a cigar. And Olcott lights the cigar. And instantly, he's in an infinite cube of space. Everything disappears. And there are flat bouquets of flowers floating through the air, like much like I would imagine the vi visuals on, mushrooms almost look like floral patterns. But it starts, he thinks it must have rained, that the guy made it also rain, this master made it rain on him, because once he finally comes back to himself after a couple of hours, he notices that his cigar is soaking wet. Now, this, think about that. I mean, it's the guy gave him the cigar. Whatever he smoked made the cigar wet, like a Mickey. Like like if we smoke DMT, it melts, right? And turns into a liquid and causes these vast experiences, much like what he describes. Now, when the Theosophical Society was first formed, we have letters that a good example of easy place to see them is in Mitch Horowitz's book on American occultism. I can't remember the title, where they're talking about why they're founding the Theosophical Society. And they're saying that it's because they want to resurrect the work of Cagliostro. They want to bring back what Cagliostro was doing. So right from the get-go, they're wanting to implement Cagliostro's system. And if you read his work, central to his system is that acacia. It centers around that acacia. Well, John Patrick Deviney, fantastic scholar, he talks about the two Theosophical societies. The first Theosophical Society was founded in New York with Alcott Blavatsky. They had a vice president named George Felt, who was a chemist, and they had a textbook. This textbook was written by a woman named Emma Harding, or Hardinge Britton. She's famous for having written a book called Ghost World, I think. It's been years. It's an incredible book. If you haven't read it, read it. It'll blow your mind. But she also wrote a book called Art Magic. And in this is the earliest reference to psychedelic mushrooms being used as psychedelics. I think it's the 1850s. And she's talking about the best way to get in touch with spiritual hierarchies is to induce the trance condition. And the best way to induce the trance condition is to use the distillations of two or three acrid fungi. And so she's talking about using magic mushrooms to talk to spiritual beings. This is to be the textbook for the Theosophical Society. Well, they've got all these people present that are ready for a demonstration. They're like, let's do some magic, you know. And George Felt steps up and he says, okay, I've discovered this drug. I'm going to burn it on a charcoal, and it's going to cause everyone in here to be able to see that elementals are real. You're going to see elementals. And in Alcott's old diary leaves, this happens. He does this, and it causes basically a riot. Everybody is so terrified. They tear up the room, they evacuate, they're, you know, they want to immediately shut down the Theosophical Society, not do this anymore. And this is when Blavatsky steps up and says, okay, we're not going to do practical magic anymore. We're going to reform, but we're purely speculative. We're just going to talk about the philosophy of this stuff. And they set all that aside. Coincidentally, Felt disappears. No one ever hears from him, sees him again. George Felt, the man who had this powder that caused this effect. I mean, when Alcott described the beings, he said they looked like something out of Francis Barrett's The Magus, if you know what those creatures look like, therianthropoid demons, you know. But I'm saying all this because, like you said, the spirits boxes are empty. Well, for them, this ascended master that handed him this cigar that, soon as he lit it up, ends up in a cube of space with flowers floating around and his cigar is soaking wet. You know, were they talking to spiritual angels, or was there someone involved? Were there people there that were playing this role? You know what I mean? There's so many questions.
I mean, Kelly was a skilled magician. Dee constantly had to rein him in and say, no, you can't practice this. You can't practice that grimoire. You have to like rein it in. He clearly knew also how to scry. It's not surprising if you want to get into lore because he was born August 1st. And there's ancient lore that if you're born on like Lunasa or Imbolc or any of those very powerful special days, then you're gifted with second sight. So he is born on one of those special days on August 1st. And he's a competent guy. He was brought there with another guy. I just finished Woolley's biography last month, so I'm fresh on this stuff and waiting for Glyn Perry's to arrive. Very excited, and it looks like D was scrying with this guy Saul, right? And it seems like these two other practitioners who knew D, one of them being Kelly or knew of D, they were like, oh, he's working with this guy who's not so great. We need to come and expose him and actually get have you like someone was like, Kelly, you need to be working with D, not Saul. Let's go to D's house and help him out here. It sounded to me
Interesting.
that's sort of what the vibe was. Because if you or I heard of a friend who was into the occult, but close to the queen, so had to be careful, maybe, and was working with someone who we knew wasn't like really that great, and maybe admittedly wasn't that great, and we knew we're like we would probably be like, hey, here's someone who could really help you out as a skilled magician to work with you and do high quality scrying. And Kelly clearly wasn't on DMT the entire time he worked with John D, doing 7 8 hour scrying sessions all day long. You can't be conscious for that long on it. I mean, I'm not convinced that they were using it at all. That's where I'm coming from. I'm close to being persuaded that they used it sometimes, but yeah,
But you're thinking in terms of blasting off. I'm not thinking. I'm thinking more in terms of fumigation. You know
I'm
that that it's something to subtly influence. Because we've used it this way. We've used it where we've had it burn for 3, 4, 5 hours, and just just add a little more on, a little more on, and you don't blast off that
Well,
way. But you do get
it's
in
200
very.
bucks a gram in Vancouver. We couldn't afford that. That would be a month's rent
You
to
got to
be able
start
to do
making
one
your own.
ritual. Oh, that would be so complicated. I don't know how I could learn how to do that
It's the most
on YouTube.
complicated thing in the world.
So yeah, no, that's what I wanted to say. Like, that's one of the other interesting parts about the diaries. They never mention suffumigation, and as every scholar knows, complete lack of a mentioning of a thing is often more important than if something's
That's
mentioned.
right. That's
So
right.
they it's and for music for magicians to not mention fumigation or what herbs they might be using is very odd. Is very odd. Even doing divine work like D was in, D wanted to go up. He didn't want to look down at all, according to the diaries, of course. In real life, who knows? But like, if you're just working with God and trying to be celestial or super celestial in Agrippan language, right? You would still use incense, like frankincense and myrrh or something, or you might run out. There'd be probably some references. So it's very suspicious. They never mentions fumigation. And a good argument would be because it was a very special fumigation.
And in regard to the possibility that these quote unquote angels could have been real men, much like Hilarion in the Alcott scenario, we do have them being given that crystal, that first scrying crystal that was later replaced. But you know, the one that's like almost like a locket on a chain.
Yeah, D's showstone, which is found in the corner. I mean, most people believe Kelly put it there and then was like, sort of gimmicked it. But maybe
Well,
it was
I
just
mean, but
there.
that
Maybe it
we
was there.
that's
Yeah.
speculating. You know,
Okay.
we can't prove either way, but the
It,
fact
of
that they
course.
do have something materializing, you know, I've encountered a number of entities on DMT, and they've never handed me something that was still there when it was over, you know.
Yeah, though I have had weird interactions with physical reality. Like,
Oh, sure.
yeah, like I've had devices that were dead without batteries unplugged on the other side of the room turn blaze to life
Wow.
and then start speaking to
I
me.
totally believe
While
it.
like the other beings that I'm engaged with, the higher ones, are like, those technology beings are the bad guys. It was terrifying, the whole experience. I was like torn between a full breakthrough and pulled back by this weird tech entity, egregore, in the physical, and my whole
Yeah.
reality was like ripped apart. It was traumatic but
John
wonderful.
Lilly has some stories like that, when he was on the airplane and shot up the ketamine and immediately starts talking to the Kohoutek comet that's coming by that tells him that it's conscious, and to prove it, it's gonna I think it says it's gonna turn all the electricity, all the electrics off in the plane, and then all the lights go out and all the electrics go out on the plane, and Lily's sitting there like, okay, can I not die, please?
Yeah, one thing I do believe in is entities, that's for sure. But I'm loving the exploration of oh look, it's 4:20 here now, exactly.
Enjoy. I wish I could join you.
We'll reconvene for part two tomorrow, and maybe it'll be an entheogenic journey that people can join us on in their viewing, who knows. So you are convinced of what? That they used it sometimes or all the time?
I wouldn't say I'm convinced of anything.
Okay.
I'm trying to make sense of the red powder, and I do
Yes.
think there is something to Ashmole's questions about it. And once you start looking at the descriptions of the red powder, that it looks like glass or crystals, and that when you heat it up, it runs and melts like wax. When it gets cool, it gets solid again.
Yeah.
I mean,
That's,
very suggestive.
if you read all the descriptions across, I love how you or you quoted someone who compiled the different descriptions of it, right? And if you,
Yeah,
you know,
I think it was Helvetius.
if you've ever seen DMT and you read through that, by the end you're just like, well, okay.
It's unreal.
It's
Yeah.
unreal. Yeah.
And when we have an alchemical tradition with Zosimos and the Turba Philosophorum stating in no uncertain terms that it's acacia, and then D quoting Turba Philosophorum, so we know he read it, and then Heinrich Kunrath, another alchemist whom we haven't discussed yet, but he went and met with Kelly and spent time with Kelly and D. And afterwards, he made a statement where he was quoting Zosimos's teacher, Maria Profetissima, where he says that the source of the stone is the same source as gum arabic. Well, gum arabic is from acacia. And this is after he met with Kelly. What did Kelly tell him about it, if anything? But it's interesting that he would come to the same conclusion after meeting this man.
Right, and what I learned in Dr. Burns's course is John Dee discovered the Zosimos material, right, in the Codex Marcianus, translated or transcribed himself a full copy in Greek,
That's right.
and a year later wrote the Monus Hieroglyphica.
That's right.
So, but one thing Burns, she's excited to read your book, she said, because she's not familiar with the entheogenic literature, I think, so much. And so she wasn't able to keep that question alive, I think, while going through the Monas. But going through the Monas Hieroglyphica with the question of, like, he might have just learned about acacia and DMT, perhaps, or
I'd love to
a
have
year
some time
later.
to sit with her, and because like I said, when I wrote Angels in Vermilion, I had no idea what I was doing. I had never written anything, and my main concern was that if I don't write it down and something happens, this might be lost for another 200, 300 years, and at the time, I really was in this odd, granted I was tripping a lot, but I was in this odd, the synchronicities piled up so deep that a lot of the answers I found I wasn't looking for. I was doing something else, and it would come up out of nowhere. That's how the Cagliostro thing happened. I was homeless at one point. My wife and I both lost our jobs of years when the economy crashed, and within 6 months we were homeless, and I had one book, and it was the Count Cagliostro's Egyptian Rite. And I'm reading this book and had no intentions or wasn't even thinking about acacia. And he says outright, that you drink this red liqueur, it's going to raise your spirits so you can understand what I'm going to say to you. Basically, as close as an 18th century person could get to saying, this is going to expand your consciousness and alter your perception. And then he tells him, this is the acacia that you were given in the degree of master in ordinary masonry, and it is the prima materia. Well, as soon as I find that, I run to Arturo de Hoyos, the grand archivist and grand historian of the Scottish Rite. And I said, look what I found. I think he's talking about tripping on DMT. DMT is an acacia. He says, well, it's funny that you come to me with this because I'm in the process of translating the Russian Rite of Melusino. And he says basically the same thing, that the acacia is the prima materia and that they're burning it on a coal, and he calls it the burning coal of Isaiah, and I was like, how is that possible? You know how the synchronicities can get so deep that you really do feel like the Blues Brothers, like you're on a you're being led by God,
And remind me again what the Ark of the Covenant was made of.
It's not just that, man. So the Egyptians, when they want to worship Osiris for the public, they would make a box out of acacia carried on poles, gilded, covered in gold, and it was full of red cakes, according to Budge. Red cakes are inside this thing that represent the body of Osiris. Well, Moses is raised by those guys. And when he runs away, what he basically does is starts a renegade priesthood. The first thing he does is let's build that box out of acacia. Let's gild it, put it on poles. Let's put the manna bread inside of it, And when this is the best part. So when Moses sees the burning bush, the Hebrew isn't burning bush, it's lebasena. Sena literally means acacia. Sena is acacia. That's the translation in the Hebrew dictionary. Leba doesn't mean burning, as in flaming. It means to glow with a spectral presence. So like a glowing acacia that's talking to him. Well, if the reader missed that allusion, he doubles it. He reinforces it. Instead of a burning bush, now we see fire on the mountain. Well, the mountain that he climbs is Mount Sinai. And when you look at the same Hebrew dictionaries, the etymological root of Sinai is Sena. So he's climbing the acacia, and the fire he encounters on the mountain is basically the fire on the acacia. Well, the best part, he comes down from that mountain and he's got horns, and there's argument about this because the word that's used to mean horns can also mean showing with light. But I think both are probably the case, that it's not th horns, it's like a crown of thorns. He's named himself the mouthpiece of this spirit. He's become consubstantial with the object of sacrifice, just like in indigenous cultures, they like coming down as a bull. Well, when he comes down, he finds the Hebrew Israelites doing what? Worshipping a golden calf. Well, they don't pull that out of a vacuum. They just left Egypt. The golden bull in Egypt is the Apis bull, a golden bull that was subsumed by Osiris in Memphis. He is a form of Osiris. Well, Osiris is what? The deity that is trapped inside of the acacia. Well, when Moses catches them worshiping this thing, do you remember what he does? What he had them do? He grinds it into a powder,
And
mixes
makes
it
them
with water,
eat
and
it.
makes them all drink it.
Drink it, yeah.
Why would he do that? It's almost like he's saying, you don't worship it, stupid, you eat it. You're missing the whole point. So m the
Stand there looking
whole,
at it, put it in your mouth. Sorry.
I think his name's
That's for the Thelemites out there.
a French scholar, Foemoth. But he talks about how statues of Osiris were always made in acacia, and then they'd be gilded. And in honor of this, statues of the deceased would be made in acacia to align them with Osiris. So That means that that bull was probably made out of acacia and then gilded, just like the Ark of the Covenant was. So when he ground it into powder and mixed it with water, that's exactly how you extract the stuff. That's how you make it in the first place. When Osiris is trapped in the tree and it's cut up into planks, those planks are thrown into the Nile. That's step one, how to make DMT class. Like you chop the wood up, you put it in the menstruum and let it extract. Well, if the pH is right, the DMT unhooks from the plant and now it's suspended in that menstruum, in that fluid. So that means part of what you put in there doesn't come back out, right? Well, guess what gets lost when Osiris gets thrown in that water in the Nile? His phallus, it's gone. It's lost to the water. The generative principle, the power of it, is still suspended in that fluid, right? I mean, what Moses was doing was creating a renegade priesthood for his Hebrew Jewish brethren and family that he felt like they were missing out on in Egypt. And being raised by those priests was very, I'm sure, was hip to what they were doing and why the Osiris mythos was so significant, so important, the same reason that Zosimos latched on to that same plant, Again, according to Grimes, Zosimos was a priest.
Right. So even if you framed it in a from an academic perspective where Moses is a legend and not a real person, even if you look at it from that perspective, you have Egyptian temple practices using essentially the acacia and therefore forms of DMT prominent in Egypt, and therefore they migrate into the hill countries of Cana and the tribal cultures there, out of which Israel formed, is one. It would be an academic way of saying it, because there's no Moses
And we get
in
it in
history,
the
according to a lot of scholars. And again, this is still a
sure
debated
sure
thing.
and
So I'm not taking a side here, folks. Just saying,
that's
even
a
if you're
valid
like, oh,
argument.
that's a that's what if I'm just saying, for all those people who are like, Moses didn't exist, so we're throwing out the argument. No, I'm just saying there's a trans. So there's a transmission of technology here, and it has to do with the acacia. And I had no idea there was any Egyptian roots for that. But again, I haven't read Zosimos yet. I'm reading the Churton book on early alchemy before I read Shannon Grimes' Becoming Gold. So it's going to be a fun
They're
rest of the
both
year
good.
journey for me. Last year was spent all in psychology and druidry studying Dr. Edwards' work. I put like
Get you a
ages into
copy
that,
of.
and this year's got a whole new focus.
Well, I don't know why. It won't let you see it. We'll get you a copy of Raphael Patai's The Jewish Alchemists. It's
Okay.
a phenomenal study, and it goes really deep into all this.
I
But you
like
can
that.
see how, there's a similarity thing happening with these motifs. Osiris is dismembered as the tree and thrown into the Nile. Well, Dionysus, the etymology of Dionysus is Dionysa, which means God tree or the God in the tree, just like Osiris. When we get to Christ, he has a symbolic dismemberment when he feeds the multitude with the bread and the fishes. The two fishes have always represented the sign of Pisces, which is when he was conceived in Easter. And the five loaves are in Jewish practice. There are, I think, 11 or 12 loaves offered, five of which signify the high priest. Well, Christ is that new high priest. So by dismembering himself to these people, he's participating in this dismemberment motif that circles these gods of drugs, of acacia and of wine. And Christ is his association with wine doesn't even need to be stressed. But when he's on that tree, instead of being in the tree, he's nailed to the tree, and on his head is a crown of thorns. Well, acacia means thorn. When Dioscorides named the species, he named it after its most defining characteristic, which were its thorns. So acacia means thorned. That crown that we talked about with Moses, he comes down and he's got horns, or does he have thorns on his head? There's all this ambiguity there that seems like the tradition at least survived symbolically. and which would explain why in some factions of Masonry, you really do have these individuals that believe they're participating in the true form of Christianity. You know, the it was lost, but Masonry preserves it. Because of course Christ was called what? A tecton, which people will translate as carpenter. It doesn't mean carpenter, it means he was a builder. He was a craftsman, just like it with in Masonry. But it explains a lot when you look at it in those terms. Now, of course, I'm not saying the Jews were using DMT or Christians were using DMT, but, and I don't even have proof that the Egyptians were using DMT, but I am thoroughly convinced that Zosimos interpreted it that way. And in doing so, instigated a tradition that fed into Masonry eventually. And along the way, it passed such bright luminaries as John Dee, Edward Kelly, Elias Ashmole, Robert Boyle. You know, so I'm not, like I said, I'm not convinced of anything, but I also have yet to encounter a better explanation.
That is a fundamental problem with all of this, in my opinion. And I don't think you can get there without actually having had experiences with DMT personally, unfortunately, because once you have, and once you look at everything from that perspective, it's so convincing that this is the thing which maybe gave birth to religion.
Right, metaphysics itself. And
I'm
I
a
think
big
about
believer that.
Terence McKenna, when he said, "If this isn't the answer, I don't think I'm interested in the question anymore."
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. What did he call it? Orange
Mothballs.
mothballs. Orange
Mothballs.
mothballs. It
Yep.
just reshapes your reality. And for people like who are in doubt of the existence of other realities or spirits or anything like that, it's kind of a panacea to that. If it doesn't convince you, then nothing will. I think maybe.
I agree.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's just sort of this human birthright that has been, that it kind of explains the war on drugs and everything else, and the urge to keep these things sequestered away from us plebs and safely within the walls of CIA's top secret programs, right? Which of course they don't run anymore.
No.
Yeah, they let go of that stuff after the hippies died out,
That's right.
which also had nothing to do with the CIA.
Nothing.
Let's be
The
clear.
Grateful Dead, San Francisco, that was not a psyop.
And the Canadian Secret Service, CSIS, who probably is listening to this with China, they have nothing to do with the CIA also. And I love you guys so much. Thank you for being you. I love Trudeau too. He is our fearless leader. Thank you so much, brave Trudeau, for protecting us. True North, strong and free. We might have to change the national anthem, actually, but we love you. So, when was the first time you did DMT, and how has that affected your experience of what we call magic?
Let's see. I had done LSD and mushrooms and mescaline hundreds of times. It wasn't until about 20 years ago that someone handed me some DMT. And
Nature provides, eh?
it was at a festival, and we got there early. And the second person to show up, I was just trying to be kind. I said, "Hey, let me help you set up your tent." You know, I helped him find a spot. They ended up camping next to us. And it turned out that he was a chemist that traveled with this band. Everywhere they went, he went, and he would hand out goodies to the crowd at a certain point. And, he let me know that he had some DMT, and instantly I felt like my heart stopped because I had been wanting to find DMT for years at this point. It was the Holy Grail, you know, you couldn't find it back then. And so finally, yeah, he turned me on, and it was unlike anything. Like, you can't compare it to LSD, you can't compare it to mushrooms, even though mushrooms, psilocybin chemically is 4-phosphor, or psilocin is 4-phosphorloxy NN-DMT. So technically it should be something like that, but it was not. I was fully immersed in a dimension that I can only describe as like a cathedral mixed with a mosque, with all of these different temple motifs in one thing. And I was overwhelmed with the feeling that we were all babies, infants, every human. Like, we're in this very early stage of our evolution, of growth, and that if you're a human, you are basically a baby. And there were beings there that were tending to us. Very feminine presence that was kind of like the daycare woman that, you know, and I knew her as soon as I saw her. I knew her. It was like, oh, I've always known this. Yeah, I've always known this. I don't know why I forget this so easy. But it was that feeling of, oh, I've always known that I'm in this temple that's a daycare where this lady with a black veil over her face keeps me. And on the veil was a spider web in green knit. It was wild. It changed everything for me. Mainly because it was the first time I had an encounter with another being in that space. And that's the real clincher. It is, you know, set and setting, when Harvard declared that set and setting was what affected psychedelic trips, what they're really doing is giving a clinical term for
Ritual
ritual.
magic.
Yep, for ritual. Yep.
Yeah.
And so it didn't take me long to learn that with the right mindset going in, and with the right objects and things around me and music, I could very much steer that ship where I wanted it to go and have encounters with, you know, Indian goddesses. And the great thing about that is it's never like what you think it's going to be. You know, you can plan it as well as you want, and you can be successful in getting there. But the real surprise every time to me is that something is always communicated to me that I didn't anticipate, that I didn't know, wasn't looking for. And to me, that's the real mark of magic, of successful magic, bringing back knowledge you didn't know to look for, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The transmutation of consciousness from lead to gold, the fact that this comes from a tree that is not a tree producing a stone that is not a stone, all the way back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, how long have we known about this? And how many times has it been forgotten and rediscovered in the West? It seems like a few, whereas many other cultures have had it for a very long time. And it does seem to be, in many ways, a cure to a lot of the modern spiritual ailments of our time, in my opinion.
I agree.
It's sad to see how much it's all being abused. But again, like you said about us being babies, we're even babies to this these substances and technologies that are only that have been, banned, and the science on them has been put back, half a century, if not more. So we are like infants playing with these with fire,
That's right.
in a way. And so, as much as I like to say I think everyone should experience this stuff, you can't really say that, because you can't not everyone should even experience meditation, as it turns out.
That's right.
Know thyself.
I remember not too long ago reading an article about a guy that went to a Buddhist retreat just to, you know, take a vow of silence and just meditate for the weekend. And he had left in handcuffs and ended up in a mental institution because he had never actually done a mantra and a meditation, and it completely threw him for a loop.
It's like, you know, when you meet those people, or maybe you're in a relationship and you're just like, oh, if my partner would only open up to see the world the way I see it, I know things would work out. It's like, maybe they'll kill you. Maybe they'll lose their shit. Maybe some people who really are just, you know, what my mom and sister have always called pod people, usually in reference to our own family.
That's right. You never know, man.
Just, you know, maybe you want to leave. Maybe they need to be in the pod, right? Like, some people need to be in the pod for this lifetime. It's where they're at, or whatever. Who
That's
knows?
why
You don't want
tell people
I don't
all the
think we
time
should convert everyone to our
about
ways of work.
silence with these organizations, masonry and stuff, where the injunction to silence,
I
lots of
mean,
folks get it in their head that we're gatekeeping and, but no, I think it has more to do with preserving another's sacred right to ignorance. It's cruel to rip somebody's carpet out from under them. It's cruel to shatter someone's worldview and then expect them to walk home and still be able to get up in the morning and wear that mask. I don't think it's our place to do that. And I can think of a few things more cruel than doing that. So yeah, I agree. I think the pod, people have a sacred right to their pod, and I don't want to be the guy to take it.
yeah, and as for those who claim we're gatekeeping, we're not gatekeeping, folks. We're podcasting. That's the
There
opposite
you
of
go.
gatekeeping.
There you go.
We're saying things on these platforms that, in open ways and transparent ways, that haven't been said this way probably in all of human history. That's what's going on with podcasting, is you have people telling the truth for the first time ever to the whole for anyone to hear.
You're doing the Lord's work.
Ideally, that's what we're trying to do, right? Like, it's what people like is the unvarnished stuff. You know, when I've touched base with a few Gen Z kids I know, usually D&D players or whatever, and I've asked them like about my approach and different things, like they say they really care about authenticity in a way that in the 90s we didn't. Like, you know, like we wanted our rock stars to be like deus absconditus, like the distant gods that were far away from us and that we just got to touch liminally at their shows or when we bought their new album or listen to their music, right? But the new generation, they want to see you setting up for the thing. They want to see the glitches. And because
Right.
that adds a level of significance and
Okay.
truth to the entire experience that they otherwise would be suspicious of. So that's an interesting thing about these young kids these days, you know.
I agree.
But I also enjoy it as a format because it allows people like you and I to essentially have a conversation like two wizards over a table on in a tavern on a windy night, just sharing our truths and wisdom and what knowledge we've gleaned along the way. And I thank you
Well,
for being
let's
here
be
for that.
thinking about planning for episode two. My wife is, she just
Episode
came
two,
to the door.
yes.
She's ready for me to get her to
Amen.
work.
She was very kind given the multiple attempts we've taken to make this happen. So yes, we will talk episode two very soon. And this has been part one, let's call it part one. Part two to be resumed, perhaps even with a little something extra on the table or in
Yeah.
the bloodstream. We'll see, folks. So stay tuned. And you know, hopefully everyone can sign on to be a part of our virtual or in-person conference with PD Newman and Dr. Burns and others this summer. So check that
That's
out.
going to be great.
That's going to be great. I want to see you and her and a few others be able to talk about this openly, a roundtable style for as long as needs to be done, as long as we can before we you know, have a celebrate John D's birthday party, which will be the big Saturday night fun thing. So yeah,
Fantastic.
I think we should wrap up the weekend with a small wake for Edward Kelly as well, you know, Irish style, because
Yeah.
he was allegedly Irish nobility. Okay,
Yeah.
I'll let you go, brother. Thank you, PD Newman, and folks, like and subscribe, as they say, and I'll see you very soon, my friend.
Thank you.